good to have you here, and I pray that your time is really filled with many, many graces. God bless you. Hope you will return again in the future. I also welcome you to the cathedral that is the home of the people of St. Mary Magdalene, she who was the first witness of the Lord's resurrection, the loyal friend of Jesus who remained beneath his cross while others fled in fear and shame, and if we may be so bold to say, the apostles of the apostles. Our patroness has hounded heaven on behalf of this local diocese, particular for this school and cathedral church placed under her care. In gratitude for her patronage, we seek to be faithful witnesses of the Lord risen in glory, to not abandon him when he suffers today, the hungry, the stranger, the sick, or the imprisoned, and to be loyal friends of God, who in Jesus of Nazareth became small for us. The choir school's motto is taken from the communion anthem. The solemnity of St. Mary Magdalene is found in the Roman Missal, Caritas Christi Virgin Nos. So we are gathered here this week in the house of St. Mary Magdalene because all of us are deeply passionate about the liturgy, and for good reason. In the liturgy, we are privileged to join the great prayer of Jesus Christ and his body of the church, addressed to the Father who is rich in mercy, and united in the commerce of their love in the Holy Spirit. We join our Savior's prayer of thanksgiving, sacrifice, remembrance, and intercession for the many needs of the church and the world. It is in this sense that we can firmly assert just why we are so passionate about the liturgy. The liturgy will save the world. Our current age has such great need. The young people who are gathered at this colloquium with us this week may rightly question what my generation has left to them. Those of us who have gone before them have tried and failed in many ways to shape a just and fair society. We are rapidly consuming the vast natural resources of our planet. We are seemingly powerless to fix the problem of famine and hunger for a billion fellow human beings. And we stand by while the gap between the rich and the poor continues to grow. Our Holy Father, Pope Benedict, has written in his encyclical letter, Caritas in Veritate, that the world's wealth is growing in absolute terms, but inequalities are at the increase. In rich countries, new sectors of society are succumbing to poverty, and new forms of poverty are emerging. In poorer areas, some groups enjoy a sort of super development of a wasteful and consumerist kind, which forms an unacceptable contrast with the ongoing situations of dehumanizing deprivation. The scandal of glaring inequalities continues. In the last century, we have barreled through a barrage of economic and political systems, all derived from the great promise of the Enlightenment and human self-fulfillment. Communism, fascism, and other forms of bureaucratic societal organization have come and gone, tragically taking with them millions of human lives snuffed out in the name of their so-called progress. And we know the difficulties of unchecked capitalism, as our world continues to suffer an economic downturn, generated largely by the cavalier greed and carelessness of some of our major financial institutions. In the last century alone, we took the lives of over 200 million human beings by means of war. Our low regard for human life allows us to defend with delight blight of political correctness, the destruction of infants, the warehousing of the elderly, the harboring in the shadows of a permanent underclass to do our most oppressive acts of labor. For all the aforementioned, the suffering is very great indeed. While we are getting Botoxed, cosmetically expanding and reducing the size of our bodily appendages or tightening the crevices of our aging faces, children are perishing in developing countries because of no access to the readily and easily available vaccine for pneumonia. And as a Vatican official recently lamented, mothers are perishing at alarming rates because they do not have access to drugs, which we know are certain to prolong the life of those who suffer the scourge of HIV infection. With the failure of our systems, programs, ideologies, and attempts at social reconstruction, what can be done to end this terror? What will inspire in us a greater commitment to the common good, the dignity of all human life, and a sense of solidarity with our fellow humanity, especially the poor and vulnerable? What is it that will save the world? Again, from our Holy Father's encyclical, development needs Christians with their arms raised toward God in prayer. Christians moved by the knowledge that truth-filled love, from which authentic development proceeds, is not produced by us, but given to us. For this reason, even in the most difficult and complex times, besides recognizing what is happening, we must above all else turn to God's love. Pope Benedict continues, development requires attention to the spiritual life, a serious consideration of the experiences of trust in God, spiritual fellowship in Christ, reliance upon God's providence and mercy, love and forgiveness, self-denial, acceptance of others, justice and peace. All this is essential if hearts of stone are to be transformed into hearts of flesh, rendering life on earth divine and thus more worthy of humanity. I have learned over the years that when you speak to adolescents and young people, you really have to focus your message. It is a great challenge and a rewarding exercise. Your communication must be succinct, compelling, comprehensive, and brief. This was the case in Mexico some months ago, when Pope Benedict spoke to a large gathering of young people in León, underneath the statue of Christ the King, Cristo Rey, erected as a monument to the memory of priests, religious, and laity who had lost their lives in the Cristero Rebellion that began in 1926. He had these profound words of advice for the young people gathered. If we allow the love of Christ to change our heart, then we can change the world. And so it is in changed hearts that true development, true change will come to address the many horrors that cry to heaven from our planet. And it is the liturgy, the great prayer of Christ and his body, the Church, by God's grace, that will change hearts. Again from Caritas in Veritate, it is Christ's charity that drives us on. The urgency is ascribed not only in things, it is not only derived solely from the rapid succession of events and problems, but also from the very matter that is at stake, the establishment of authentic fraternity. The importance of this goal is such as to demand our openness to understand it in depth and to mobilize ourselves at the level of the heart so as to ensure that current economic and social processes evolve towards full human outcomes. The liturgy, this work of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, will save the world. It is this conviction that drives the passion on us for a most noble, engaging, integral celebration of the Mass and the Liturgy of the Hours. We respond to the injunction of the Apostle Paul, for as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes again in glory. Of primary concern for all of us gathered this week is the musical life of our liturgical prayer. Singing is among the most primal and elemental of all human forms of expression. requiring no further medium than food in the human person. We are dedicated to the ongoing and further use of proper texts, so crucial to the liturgy. Worthy, long-standing, ordinary settings that are universally applicable, both in performance and capable of transcending cultural diversity. We share a concern for the deracination that has occurred from the fount of our sacred music, and which remains a vital source for new musical development and composition. We mourn the loss of a vast treasury of musical prayer, shelved and sidelined by a very narrow view of progress, perhaps too great a confidence in the social engineering of liturgical prayer, and a misplaced enthusiasm for the novel and the immediately satisfying and intriguing. The liturgy will save the world, and the musical life of this prayer is one of the primary elements that positions the liturgy to do its saving work. It is precisely this same passion and conviction that served as the inspiration for the founding of the choir school at the Cathedral of Emmanuel. The choir school was founded as one small agent of liturgical renewal and restoration in service to the liturgy that is indeed the source and summit of the life of the church, advancing God's kingdom by the sanctification of souls and the changing of hearts, rendering sacrificial praise and thanksgiving to God. A Roman Catholic choir school in Salt Lake City, Utah. Really? In what follows, I want to answer three major questions about the choir school, with the hope that this talk will serve as a call and encouragement for the founding of more choir schools to serve the liturgy and our respective ecclesial communities. So three questions. How did we get started? What does the choir school do? And what are the critical lessons learned enabling the success of a choir school? So question one, how did we get started? In the spring of 1990, we announced the opening of an after-school program for boys and girls that was to be housed at the cathedral known as the Lutheran Choir School. We conducted brief and simple auditions in the Catholic schools throughout the valley. If a child could negotiate the octave leap in the third phrase of Happy Birthday and go on to successfully sing the descending thirds and seconds, they were in. Invitation letters were distributed, and we were off to a start with roughly 35 boys and 35 girls in grades 5 through 8. We began with a weekly rehearsal, evolving to a twice-weekly rehearsal, and made it very slow. Gradual progress. A critical feature of the early success of the choir was the annual summer camp, where we were able to, over the course of a week, rehearse, instruct the students in music theory, sight singing and ear training, basic principles of the liturgy, and more. This week was always a huge success, and we mastered repertoire for the coming year, and grew immensely in our musical and liturgical knowledge. It prompted one of the parents to comment. The children learned more in 1 week's time than they accomplished after several months of weekly rehearsal. Aha! 1990 was also the year the cathedral was preparing to close for an 18-month period of restoration. In the discussions about the future work of the cathedral, Monsignor Francis Mannion and I considered the pipe dream of an actual choir school at the cathedral. While giving the matter a brief deliberation, we would generally chuckle at the overwhelming odds against such a thing. However, the dream remained alive and was soon to be taken up by parents who recognized the great value of this education, musical and liturgical formation, and experience. In fact, the summer camp comment began to take on a life of its own. In 1995, we appointed a committee and launched a feasibility study slated to review with detail the various aspects of a potential school: academics and curriculum, financial viability, physical plant. Could you really open a new school in a basement? After months of work, we were somewhat surprised to discover that the results of the study were positive. In May of 1996, the final review was submitted to Archbishop George Niederauer, who on May 26, 1996, approved the opening of a new Catholic school at the Cathedral of Emmanuel. I remember vividly the response to this news of both Monsignor Manning and myself. Now what do we do? But with the announcement of the school's opening, a parent gathering was held, and the school was full in a matter of days. This was all rather shocking, and a very big risk being taken on the part of his parents. The school did not have a principal or a single faculty. There were no books, no desks, or other materials necessary for the proper functioning of the school. After a very hectic summer, the school opened on August 26th of that same year, with 96 students in grades 4 through 8. When I mentioned earlier our patroness hounding heaven, this is certain proof of that statement. We were blessed with an outstanding faculty and staff right at the outset of the school, and a very vibrant and supportive parent community who sacrificed and worked to get this fledgling school off to a great start. We quickly realized that the basement of the cathedral was not a permanent home, and work began on a capital campaign to enable the purchase of our current campus. In December of 2002, after 6 years in the basement, we moved from our tight quarters to the campus we have today. The new campus allowed us to begin expanding the student body, eventually including classes from pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. Enrollment continues to climb as we yearly add an additional classroom to a grade level. This August, we will welcome over 300 students, and given the current admissions trajectory, our projected enrollment will finally be reached in the year 2018 with a student body of just under 500 young men. Question two, what does the choir school do? Our first and most important work is to serve the public worship life of the cathedral. The choristers serve as the trebles for the cathedral choir. They do so in two groups, the boys and the girls. The cathedral choir assists at all Sunday masses and masses on solemnities and feasts of the Lord throughout the choral term. The boys and girls alternate in joining the men of the choir so that on a given Sunday or solemnity, it might be a choir of men and girls or a choir of men and boys. The choristers also assist at Mass every day, Monday through Thursday at the 5:15 p.m. Mass. The boys assist on Mondays and Wednesdays. The girls assist on Tuesdays and Thursdays. What does Mass with the cathedral choir and choristers look and sound like? At the daily Masses, the choir processes, singing the proper Gregorian intro. The ordinary of the Mass comes from one of the 18 chant ordinaries, or a treble setting of the ordinary, although I must admit, and I think my colleagues will agree, treble ordinaries get a bit tiresome. We look forward to the day that we will be able to staff the daily Masses with the men as well. Depending on the solemnity of the day, motets are sung at the preparation of the altar and the communion. Daily Mass concludes with the singing of the proper Marian antiphon before the shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Sunday Masses and solemnities also begin with the singing of the proper Gregorian intro. The ordinary, a choral setting ranging from Alonzo Lobo to Francis Poulenc, proper motets as much as possible, and a communio chant during Holy Communion. The choral term currently runs from the Sunday following Labor Day to the solemnity of Corpus Christi, with the addition of a period of time extending from our patronal feast on July 22nd, a very important day, through the Assumption of Our Lady. In addition to the Masses, the choir assists with Vespers on Christmas Day, Easter Day, Pentecost, many other solemnities, the Sundays of Advent and Christmas season, and the season of Easter. What are the various ensembles that function at the cathedral? This is still a matter of development as we grow. But I mentioned to you already the two primary ensembles from the school being the Boy Choir, the St. Gregory Choristers, and the Girl Choir, the St. Cecilia Choristers. A group of our most qualified boys and girls come together in what is known as the Scola. The Scola performs with men of the choir at major festivals and occasions. This is the group that you will hear at tonight's performance. There is also a training choir known as the St. Nicholas Choir, a subset of the boy choristers made up of boys still in the school with changing or changed voices. They rehearse separately and are integrated into the service schedule. Additionally, we have a growing high school women's group made up of graduates that is beginning to take shape, and we have a high school young men's group also made up of graduates. Both of these groups are regularly integrated into the service schedule as well. What else does the choir school do? I describe three other important elements of our work. A concert season, performance tours and pilgrimages, and collaboration with other professional arts organizations. First, the concert season. The choir has a regular concert season with 12 to 20 performances per year, in which we celebrate that great treasury of sacred music. The concert season of the previous year included Cherubini's Requiem, Schubert Magnificat, Dvorak's incredible Stabat Mater, the Vaughan Williams Mass in G minor, and other works. Annually, the choristers perform Britten's A Ceremony of Carols several times during the holidays, and Pergolesi's Stabat Mater as a choral meditation on the afternoon of Good Friday. Other seasons have presented such works as Britten's St. Nicholas and His Nose Flood, the Bach St. John Passion, and the Mendelssohn Paulus. A high point for me, probably, a performance of Messiaen's three small liturgies of the Divine Presence, a truly remarkable and exhilarating work. The concert season is an opportunity for the choir school to provide a service to the larger community by offering these three public performances of these great works of art. The concert season has also been the primary way we have accessed the financial support of the larger community, and it drives a very successful annual appeal made on behalf of the choir school each year. Second, performance tours and pilgrimages. The choir travels annually, with international tours alternating with tours within the Western United States. Every 4 years, the choir travels to Rome, so that each child in the school will have the opportunity to experience this pilgrimage and performance opportunity. In the coming year, we are traveling to Berlin, Leipzig, Prague, and Vienna. Tours are, of course, great experiences in and of themselves, but they serve us primarily as something of a choral boot camp. Nothing whips a choir into shape as much as the pressures of a performance tour. And so, from a very practical and musical standpoint, the tours are a great benefit to the work of the choir school. Finally, collaboration with other arts organizations. Thanks in large part to the work of my colleague, Melanie Linker, the choir school regularly supplies Utah Opera and Utah Symphony with treble choristers whenever they are called for live repertoire learning of these organizations. We are currently preparing the boys for the Magic Flute, and last year performed the MOM and opened the symphony season with a work of John Adams. These performances with professional arts organizations have been an invaluable experience for the children. In past years, we have also collaborated to a great extent with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, including a once-in-a-lifetime joint performance of the Battle of the Republic. That was meant to be really fun. So that is what we as the choir school do. Question 3. What are the critical lessons learned enabling the success of the choir school? While the cathedral was closed for restoration in the early 1990s, I was given the opportunity to travel to London's Westminster Cathedral, and over a 3-month period, examine the Carter School, its day in and day out function, and experience the incredible music and liturgical work of this choir. I was also able to travel to several other choir schools throughout England. I was very earnest to learn of the pedagogical techniques that produced these brilliant choirs, and what specific instruction was given to the boys in order to attain the great level of excellence with which they regularly performed. When I met with the various organists and choir masters, my question was always met with a cross-eyed response and a certain bewilderment. Generally, these questions produced puzzlement and mystification. I was really disheartened that there seemed to be no one who could articulate what it was that wrought these magnificent sounds. Later, I realized the source of the bewilderment and perplexity. The choir schools did not have an articulated method of training the choristers, because the method had been in place in the daily routine of the cathedral and choir schools for centuries. While not being that well-learned, the choir school at Westminster was a perfect example. These are a few of the critical factors, I think, that lead to the success of the choir school based on my observation of these organizations. First, the regular daily assistance at the liturgy. A daily sung liturgy is crucial to the building up of a choir. The development of a large body of repertoire, the maintenance of a high standard of performance. Building up to this kind of thing can be very painful, and we've been through that pain, I can assure you. And a commitment of this kind can be vexing in our day, an age as parents and children do not often take part in activities this long term. It has taken a great deal of education and orientation. In the end, I have told our parents that we here at the Cathedral of the Magdalene are actually choir school light, in that between the boys and the girls, our choristers share the responsibility of the daily and Sunday masses, and so perform only half the services of a typical choir school. I've collected data from the various cathedrals and choir schools detailing the service schedule, how often the choruses are singing, etc., and I've put this in graphic form for our parents to see. It is quite enlightening to them. Again, crucial to the development of the choir is the regular assistance at the liturgy. A second critical factor, a clear sense of deputed ministry. At Westminster Cathedral, the choristers are very charmingly vested, as if they were diminutive miniature monsignors. However, this is not just some kind of show. At Westminster, choir is deputed by the cathedral's chapter of canons to perform the daily liturgies of the cathedral on its behalf. Because of this, the choir officially dons the vesture of the chapter. There is a very clearly established and well understood role for the choir. They have a clear and engaged sense of the importance of their ministry. In the United States, by some machination, we do not have cathedral chapters. This role is most often subsumed by the diocesan college of consultors. But having some clearly defined sense of the ministerial role of the choir is crucial to its success. This is something children can really sink their teeth into, and it carries them through the demanding months of service they offer to the church. People need a sense of their place and role. While the full participation of the congregation remains a very worthy goal in our liturgical celebrations, the choir has suffered a tremendous loss in the understanding of its ministerial function. Cardinal Vaughan's original vision for Westminster Cathedral included a community of Benedictine monks to be in residence, bearing responsibility for the daily office and the daily celebration of Mass. A conflict about the pastoral leadership of the cathedral ensued and thwarted Cardinal Vaughan's vision. but the choir school and the choir have been able to perform a significant role in forwarding this vision. A third critical factor, event versus institutional models of formation. Everybody loves choristers around Christmas time. Inevitably, the major newspapers and television stations of Salt Lake City stalk around the cathedral for a photo shot of the choristers at Christmas. Everyone delights to the soaring descant topping off the lustily rendered singing of the first Noel. But what about February 21st? We don't just remove the choristers from their closets, dust them off, and set them to singing the Christmas standards. What I have just described alludes to a greater challenge we face, I think, in church music today, the event versus the institution. I would argue that we need less events and more institutions. The event has tragically become a model for formation. We go to great expense as a church to sponsor conventions, which gather like-minded individuals together for hyper-intensive sessions, workshops, talks, and unreal, perhaps unnatural, ecclesial gatherings for worship. Now, I would have to grant a great exception to the leaders and participants in this colloquium. They go to great lengths to prevent this annual week of study from turning into a typical convention, and I believe that gatherings of this kind are very profitable. That being said, we need less conventions and more schools. Conventions are short-lived, often very minimal in actual consequence, and not terribly profitable for the parish or community they are intended to actually serve. You cannot ground adults in the chant and choral tradition of the church, give them skills for new composition of quality, or advance their vocal production or choral technique greatly, or develop a healthy and sound liturgical spirituality in a week's time. We need less conventions and more schools. This event versus institution challenge plays out in other ways as well. The direction for diocesan and cathedral liturgies is often not coming organically from the resident ensemble or body of musicians, but rather from middle-level administrative offices. Sometimes, cathedral musicians who make music at the prayer in their buildings on a daily and weekly basis are not involved at all in major diocesan events, as we witnessed only a few weeks ago at the installation of an archbishop on the East Coast. This is not to question the value of diocesan agencies, I'll leave that to you, in service to the larger church, but a greater level of support is needed for our choral foundations and institutions, especially in the cathedrals. This would provide a more substantive and long-term solution to the challenges we face in celebrating these important gatherings of the local church. I hope I've answered the few questions with which I began. How did the choir school get started? What does the choir school do? And what are some critical lessons learned in enabling the success of the choir school? I want to conclude with a few further reflections on the value of the choir school. First, vocations to the priesthood and religious life. In October of this year, our first alumnus will be ordained a deacon in Rome, and then return later in the spring for priestly ordination in this cathedral. This young man was trained for choir school, continued service in the cathedral choir, knows the Gregorian Proverbs, is versed in the church's vast musical tradition. His liturgical spirituality was planted and nourished here. I hope that he is the first of many. Second, the choir school is in a very interesting position with regard to a challenging pastoral reality of the cathedral and the diocese. Almost 70% of Catholics in Wicklow are Hispanic. The majority are Spanish-speaking, and largely comprised of more recent immigrants coming to Utah after the mid-1990s. The Hispanic population in our parish has led to the establishment of a second Sunday Mass in Spanish every weekend at the cathedral, and this community continues to grow. At the choir school, we have determined that we must respond to this pastoral reality. In the last 5 years, we have enacted a scholarship program to begin the inclusion of children from the Hispanic community into the choir school. This has been no little challenge financially and academically, as we have had to strengthen our ability to properly engage English language learners, and also for the community at large, being sure these families are fully incorporated into the community in choir school. Most of the families have had a little prior opportunity for instruction in music. Coming from Mexico and Central America, they have a very stable, remarkably stable body of repertoire with which they are all very familiar. This presents a great challenge to the musicians in the cathedral to properly serve this community, who often struggle in so many ways that liturgical music is not high on their list of concerns. However, the incorporation of these students, giving them musical and liturgical formation and experience with the great treasury of sacred music, is proving highly successful and creating hope for a bright and promising future. I will say, this is a long ways off. There's a lot of work left to be done. But I count this work, and I know that my colleagues join me, as a particular blessing. Finally, the great grace that I have discovered. Liturgy does not always constantly demand my vigorous leadership, or my strong intention, or my strong participation. Sometimes I need to lead or participate most ardently. But other times, it simply carries me, buoys me up, and grants me the grace to stay at it. The liturgy will save the world. In the liturgy, the great song of the church, Dilexisti Justitia, Tibi Dixi Corbeo, Magnificat Anima Mea, Nos Alta Gloria. In this song, God transforms and changes hearts, advances his kingdom, enabling us to build a civilization of love. Choir schools can do much to create this song. Let me close with this thought of Pope Benedict. The church is to transform, improve, and humanize the world. But how can she do this if at the same time she turns her back on beauty, which is so closely allied to love? For together, beauty and love form the true consolation in this world, bringing it as near as possible to the world of the resurrection. The church must maintain high standards. She must be a place where beauty can be at home. Thank you.